All right, so we're starting.
This is the fourth class in language and meaning, I think. And we're sort of falling behind bit by bit from the readings. So I'm already predicting that the Henry Baltoff reading for this week will probably continue for next week. So I'm not even going to pretend that we're going to get through McGilchrist and then do Baltoft, but I'd like to, if it works, we'll do a half class on finishing McGilchrist and then half a class on Baltoff. And just as a, because I looked at it this morning, did anyone else look at the Eckhart Tolle YouTube video? Oshin, you put it up, didn't you? I think as a matter of interest, right, biographical interest, if you're interested biographically in my past, you know I mentioned Barry Long a week or so ago. I think the world ought to know that Leonard Toller, as he was with Barry for many years. Doesn't care to mention it that nowadays, unless he's cornered by Australian journalists. So a lot of what Eckhart Tolle has to say, if you know Barry Long, you'll realise that there's a kind of a source. Not that he's just a carbon copy of Barry, but in a way he's brought a lot of what Barry had to say to the masses, if you like. But in doing so, he changed the... this is just for people, for a general interest. He changed the message so that it became acceptable for a mass audience in two ways, two very important ways. One, he made it acceptable to Christians, right? He wouldn't have gotten to Oprah if he hadn't made it an acceptable sort of message for people who believed in Christianity. And the second area where he's diverged is he's made it into a kind of a movement where everything's going to end well, a vision of the future where it's all... the talk was really about that, where it's all part of a sort of a plan, the evolution of human consciousness on Earth. It's all part of a plan, and if you're with Eckhart, you're in line and you're in tune with that plan, and you're part of the evolution of consciousness on Earth, which isn't something that Barry ever said.
That's what people really want to hear, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of I guess I'm saying this because I just feel I should reflect back to you the way I see Eckhart Tolle in relation to where he's come from. You know, because all that he was talking about the Golden Age, you know, that's all straight out of Barry. And the voices talking to you in your head, you know, if you read The Origins of Man and the Universe, and he was there, you know, when Barry was writing that. And it's not, I don't say he's plagiarised him or anything, because where was Barry getting it from, right? It's all in the psyche somewhere. But I guess I can't really listen to Eckhart without thinking, Barry, you know, so I just thought it was interesting. You know, there's a synchronicity there that you chose to put that up after I was talking about The Origins of Man and the Universe, and that reminded you of Eckhart Tolle.
Well, yeah, I heard it, and then it corresponded to what we were saying.
So there's a deep...
I wasn't aware of this video before.
Yes.
It just so happened that somebody...
Yes. So there's a kind of a deeper... I thought, there's an interesting story there, in a way.
Mm.
And at a certain level, he's been of a kind of a a tremendous service as well to all the stuff that Barry had to say. He's actually got it out into the world. I feel like millions of people know about it now. A handful of kind of devotees who used to go and listen to him in council chambers in Southport in Australia, or in Highgate in London. So that's just a little background there, but there's a lot here in what we're talking about in this course that sort of overlaps with what people like Eckhart Tolle are saying about what's going on with consciousness on Earth. And I guess, you know, you might wonder, well, where's John on this? And I guess my sort of where I come from here, particularly in relation to this idea that it's where are things going, I don't know. That's where I stand. I'm not sure. I've got a sort of a sense, but we all universalize our position. I've got a sort of a sense that nobody really knows. That's the nature of how it is here. We grasp at a, we like to have a certain narrative about, well, we know where it's going, but I sometimes think about this like you're given the brochure before you come down, and basically you have to have complete amnesia. If there is a place where you can kind of see the whole picture, part of the deal of being born here is you get amnesia. You're born into a state of uncertainty, which is uncomfortable.
And liberating.
I think the unknown is. Yeah.
Yes, I mean there's something about it, right? If it was not like that, and a few people did know what it was all about and where it's going, and there is a sort of a story here, you wouldn't need to live it. Do you know what I mean? It's almost like the living of it is the unfolding of the very story. And if it was all kind of prearranged, I mean, what? I don't like to get. What were the gas chambers all about? Do you know there are? I'm sorry, Eckhart starts this off in me. You know, so that's. You can't really encompass everything that's happened on Earth in that simplistic way, I think.
The best thing that happens is when you realise that the world is not the way you thought it was. Yeah. So I remember when I was in my teens, I felt really depressed and everything. I grew up in South Africa and it was everything was sort of very narrow and it just, everything felt like a stone, and it was as though everything that people knew, they knew, and it was very boring for a long time. And whenever I hear something or I read something that shows me that things are not the way I thought they were, it's always like, wow, this is great, because if you knew, if everything really was, this is how it is, you go to school and that's how everything is and it just carries on like that, then it's just the most depressing thing. So.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes.
My question is it unfolding? Is it fixed up there or wherever it is? Or are we not helping to create it, constantly create it?
This is what I think.
Yes.
So, the chamber, or the chambers, you know, the gas chambers, didn't just come from somewhere.
No.
That was, you know, we're thinking of things like morphic resonance, you know, we're thinking of Maturana and the, you know, the creation of love coming. It wasn't. He talks about it, you know, starting off embodied, but there's somewhere up here that the thing becomes manifest. So are we not helping to... We're part of creation, you know, we're not helping to create these things.
How do people choose as well, though? Because there has to be one person, like a germ or like a crystal, or that kicks it off, something like the gas chambers. How does everybody...
I don't think it's one person. I think, and if we're talking about, I mean... Tolle talks about, and he isn't the only one. I mean, tall, long. You're talking about a lineage of people who've had certain experiences that they're talking about. You know, however they, whatever words they're using, it's coming from that something about how we as humans are making this world. You know, we have a part in it.
Yes.
And so I think someone like Tol Long, the Buddha, whoever, they're saying, look, have we not got a choice in making something else?
This is the class. This is language and meaning.
Oh, good.
Is this where you want to be?
Yes.
Kind of, yes. To become, make a machine, to do something that what's latent in people that makes them vulnerable to that kind of ideology.
It's another way. That machine was to do with the machine mind, wasn't it? It's to do with a whole worldview of thinking, and we're really going down that road, some of us, where, you know, we see ourselves as machine, we're into cyborgs now, and, you know. So what is making us create something else, this other kind of human? We're another kind of...
I'm not sure about us, you know, like, I mean, I think... I don't think the human race has become unified in its behaviour. I mean, human beings are full of conflict and antithesis, you know, fighting against ideas, fight ideologies, fight against each other. I mean, I don't like us, do you know what I mean? I don't see myself as, you know, like every other person, you know, at all. And I think talking in these generalities, for me personally, isn't very helpful.
Mm. Well, I use the word us because I think it's all of us, you know, helping to create this world, whether it's, you know, I'm very much into Buddhism and shamanism, so I see the ancients as having contributed, and we're carrying a certain amount of that, and as individuals we might choose a particular way of seeing, but ultimately there's something else going on where we create these worldviews that we imbibe. So that's why I like to say us. So
yeah.
It is a huge generalization.
Well, no, we always get back to this. It's philosophical, really.
Mm-hmm.
There's always us and being an individual. There's always a dualism.
Mm-hmm.
You know that. Seeing it either way is wrong, but seeing both at the same time is, you know, yes, it requires you to transcend your usual way of thinking.
Paradox, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's in the middle.
I mean, you're reminding. It's a Barry Long day. He did sort of present a picture once of one of those, you know, glitter ball things in a disco. Like each one of us is a facet on the ball, if you like. But there's still only one ball. There's still only one, or what he would say, the great body of humanity.
Mm.
So we're all kind of plugged into something that we've inherited as well. You know. But everyone's down a different stream as well. I think it does matter that I'm English. You know, I'm sort of plugged into a certain sort of cultural stream from being English, but back all of those cultural streams sort of lead back to a certain unity, which is just, you know, life on Earth, which I suppose is linked further back to something universal, but I don't know about that. But just one thing that you were saying, Marina, that I guess I got a certain feeling of morality or ethics, which I can't find it hard to describe. But I feel that it must matter what we do here, in our each of our lives. That what we do here matters, even if we don't do much, even if we do a tiny thing. That in some way or other. You know, it matters if we do something that isn't good, and it matters if we do something that is good. That the whole thing is we're all interconnected in all of the little things that we do in our lives and the way we lead our lives. It all matters. It's not part of some kind of script. Do you know? And if it is part of some sort of script, I feel, do you know, somewhere in here, I feel that's wrong.
To have to go through this.
Yeah. To have to go through all of this as if some god in the sky said, okay, this is it. And yet it's, you know, there are... We're not in a place where we see the whole picture. That's also what I'm saying. You know, we're just thrown. You know, Heidegger says this. We're just thrown. We're just thrown here.
I suppose from an existential point of view, you would perhaps unite to that duality between the individual and the mass of the human being by saying that our position in human evolution is part of our facticity.
Yes.
Just as not having wings or not being able to fly, I can't transcend my position in human evolution, but I can still make decisions over and above that.
Yes.
Within my facticity.
Yes.
I still make choices. I'm not. I don't like to feel that I'm carrying out God's will or destiny or fate or some kind of inexorable flow of events, and I'm just a puppet in that. I will not accept that.
Yes. I guess, but another aspect which is we may have been looking at here is, it takes a certain amount of effort to not be a puppet. It's possible, I think, to live a puppet-like life, where what you take to be your decisions, you can see really were determined by the stuff that was just put on you. You know, it's not as simple as just. I feel like there's something like there's an edge of consciousness that you can get to where you can take an action that is free, but it takes a certain.
No, you have to become conscious of your conditioning to do that.
Yes.
You have to say, well, I'm only doing that because that's how I was brought up. Now I have a choice. Now I've seen that, I have a choice. I don't have to do this.
Come in.
Becoming aware of it.
Sorry.
Let's give you freedom.
Sorry.
That's all right. Come in. So that was actually a. Is it Toll or Toller?
Toller, I thought.
Yeah, I never came.
Yeah,
I was. We were talking about you missed the. I just had a bit. I mean, I know a bit about him. I know people who knew him before he was Eckhart, and you know when he was.
The chair, sorry. It's a bit creepy.
Oh no, we're on tape here. We're on tape here, and so I'm not saying anything.
He's not charismatic, that's for sure.
No. No. Oops.
I was just thinking with what he's saying about the returning of the prodigal son and the whole thing being some sort of a problem of, you know, increasing in consciousness of some sort.
Yes.
Or a process that actually is kind of going in, you know, give or take, it's going in one direction, which is progress or improvement or whatever,
yes,
or refining or something. I mean, if you look at that, if you look at the past, then give or take, this has been a process. And even if you look from the beginning of the universe, where everything was one thing, and then it becomes different elements, and then those elements become life, and then life is kind of becoming more sophisticated. And even if you take all of human progress aside, even the difference between a monkey and a one single cell creature is huge. And it's a process of actually becoming more sophisticated, more capable, more organized. And obviously what happens with humanity is, you know, if you ask about the gas chambers, I mean, you know, it's very close to home because, you know, my family, my grandfather family all perished there. And you know, you could say that for the individuals who were queuing to go into the gas chambers and were suffocating inside the gas chambers, and of course, it has been a very terrifying, you know, beyond what we can see. But in a way, the gas chamber meaning for humanity, it had a meaning. It did have a meaning because it did show us how you know, how bad we can get if we're not, you know, standing guard or letting our egoistic hatred, you know, take the best of us. So for the individual, if you ask me, yeah, would you volunteer to go to the gas chambers to be part of this lesson to humanity? Of course, I would say on the individual level, I would say no. But if we look at things on the great scheme of things, then it's a phenomenal thing. It's phenomenal what it made us understand about us, and with that regard, it's priceless.
Yes. I'm too much of a philosopher, I suppose, to not to see that, you know, history is a story. So there are many ways that you can put it together, what it meant. And it's unclear to me that there is. I mean, if we read Bortov, in a way, I think you'll. I don't know if you have.
Yeah.
In a way, you know, he was talking about the meaning of a text. What we're talking about here is the meaning of history.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have a single meaning in that way. I mean, as soon as you were saying about that, of course, what responds in me is my understanding of that, which of course is a different to yours, which is more those events impinge on my everything that I've been through. You know, each one of us sees it differently, and that you know, that text, the meaning of history, I find that's the one that I don't think anyone can read that with any certainty. I guess that comes back to what I was saying at the beginning.
You can intuit.
Yes.
Things.
Yes.
Would you mind? What did he say about the meaning of his report?
He was talking about the meaning of a text, like a novel or a poem, that it's not unique. There's no unique fixed meaning, but neither is it subjective. Neither is it a matter of everybody has their own view. Like, that's why I'm talking about history. Everybody has their own view of history, which means there isn't really any truth behind it. Whereas he would say, in a novel or a poem, there is a truth. There's the novel or the poem, and similarly in history, there is a truth. There are the actual events that happened, but there's no one kind of meaning that you can draw out and say this is the meaning of history or this is the meaning of the text.
I suppose it's kind of the nature of the way we work, that whatever we're given, whatever materials we're given, whether they're physical or whether they're historical facts, we make them into something, we make them into something else. So we craft history into what suits us, I suppose.
Well, I feel like, funnily enough, we've bumped into what the Bortov reading is about.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't agree entirely with the very heart of that is goes into phenomenology, where you're actually receptive to something, and it produces something in you. So we're talking about, you know, I was just beginning to get the feeling of if you're receptive to something like the Holocaust, truly receptive, you don't make it into something, it evokes something in you.
Perhaps you do, well, in order to be able to process something that awful people do, people write books about old people, because otherwise it just burns you up.
Yes. Yes, I mean, I feel, you know, we're moving into a place where we probably will recur on this when we consider that Heidegger was a member of the Nazi Party in this course, although Maria and I have been through this before. So, but no, I don't think you'll be able to, I predict. But I think we're going to have to... This is like an area which you see where we can... I think I'd like to get through the end of McGilchrist before we look into this I think what I mean is I'm leaving it now, but I think it's not going to leave us. You know, it'll come back.
Did you revoke his membership at any point?
No. He just had a sort of a breakdown, you know, at the end of the war. There wasn't a, he didn't leave the Nazi Party. The Nazi Party stopped being in existence.
I don't know if anyone saw the Guardian article during the week, and it's about a book that's just won the Costa Prize, but I thought it was amazing to hear about someone who'd gone through the Warsaw uprising and had seen what was going on. It wasn't Jewish himself, but decided to be a witness, and this is meant to be a true story, that he actually went into, I don't know if it was Dachau or whether it was Auschwitz, but he actually went in there as to witness and to send out messages as to what was really going on. Because it was said, wasn't it, that Churchill and various countries knew what was going on in an earlier date than they actually said in regards to the camps. And this guy perished too. And he was trying to, that they were just trying to resist in their own small way. Certain people in there, some people couldn't, but some people were, and that he was sending out messages. And just going back to what John said about how you, I don't know if it impinges on us or how you feel it. I mean, you can't be unsensitive even now, and I think it is important that it's spoken about now, that a lot of some victims are still alive, because I think history does, it's important, isn't it?
And I think it does go through it. I mean, they say now there's some research showing that genetically that you inherit what that your great grandfather or grandfather went through. You know, they say, I mean, I've read little articles here and there, nothing really definitive, but that you do, that you, I don't know how true that is or not, but that you, people who are born of that family, you know, I don't know.
I think it's just, I've heard that too, but it's the kindergarten,
DNA.
It's all of it. In terms of that, if there are different strands, if you're British, if you're French, if you're Israeli, whatever, it's more that you can pick up on that. That we need collectively to pick up on it. I'm kind of sick, and that you mentioned earlier about how it's important that we defend, just basically learn from it, because there are instances since then that I don't think we have. You could think about the killing fields in Cambodia. But then again, you know, you do have witnesses there. That perhaps that's their role. Perhaps that is to remind us of trying to be better to one another. The Rohingyas is another one. But I'll leave it there.
The scary thing of the youth in Germany, the right hand, the right wing youth. I remember that now, even though the right wing youth that are neo-fascists.
Yeah.
But you think, oh God, it's coming up again.
When there's a distance, isn't there, from the event, so it's like fantasizing this persona that they think is so
that football game that they
Well, I mean the I think I'm reasonably I'm quite influenced by Carl Jung in relation to what the war and the genocides that occur, the causes of it all are in the human psyche. And the reason that they're recurring is because people are remain unconscious about the deeper levels of the human psyche, and our attempts to say, look, wasn't the Holocaust awful, we mustn't do that again, by just publicising it, don't go. They create, you know, like in the British, a kind of a, in there is a sense of, well, it wasn't us, you know, we didn't do it.
Yeah.
That was terrible. It's terrible what they did, and there's still all the people who weren't involved. The old finger. The old finger doesn't go. It's the meaning of the Holocaust. It's got to be in here. In what we, but that's another course. I feel that's another course, isn't it? It's my own fault. I took us all in this direction, and now I'd like to, if I could attempt to bring us back to McGilchrist and where we left it last week. We were talking about language and power. In fact, in the Roman Empire, which is it's in relation to this. Yes, we were talking about the left and right brain. Remember, this is the great theme of McGilchrist's book. And another thing that I was thinking of, about the book, one of the messages of the book is that the left brain is more or less in charge of what we think now. We were talking about this. It's a picture of the evolution of the human race, and I guess the thing that I realised this morning is, including what we think the right brain is. So there was an element, I guess, in the class last week where I was thinking, oh yeah, people's first impressions of what the right brain is what the left brain tells them it is. Do you see and the left brain in this narrative? It assimilates everything. Do you get what I mean? It assimilates everything. You can't tell it anything that will actually stop it. It'll say, "Oh yeah, I understand that," and files it away.
Is that the left brain?
Mm.
So what you're saying is that the emissary tells us what the master is.
Yes. Yes, and I was trying to express this a little bit last week, but what phenomenology is about, one way of understanding it, is it's an attempt to open up a kind of a channel of communication with this other intelligence, which ordinarily is active in a way that we're not aware of. Doesn't mean it's inactive, doesn't mean it's not working, doesn't mean it's not actually framing your very life, but we spend most of our time listening to a stream of thought that is out of touch with the background from which it is emerging. So one of the aspects of phenomenology is this informing of the intellect, which you could say is a left brain thing. It's the informing of the intellect that there is something behind it. Because philosophy is still a sort of a left brain activity, but it's a left brain activity that's attempting to balance things. For me, good philosophy. It's very. As soon as you get an idea. There's a great temptation to start dividing everything up. You say, "Oh, that's left, that's right, that's left, that's right." But I'd like to just. It's one way of understanding philosophy. That division between analytic and continental philosophy. It's never clear cut. But the analytic philosophy is a left-brainy, inspired, let's make everything clear-cut. Let's be precise in what we say. Let's not deal with any imprecise concepts. It's very much a breaking things into pieces and putting them together again in a logical and very structured and conscious way. That's more on the left brain, and the continental philosophy, at its heart, I would say the core philosophers that have inspired it, and I put Heidegger right in the middle there, have had some kind of contact with the background. That doesn't mean that continental philosophers haven't... I always regard them as riffers. It doesn't mean the left brain type of intelligence can still get hold of that material and make it its own.
It's more applicable to our people. When I read the phenomena kindergarten, immediately I feel all this emotion, human emotion. He described the human emotion. Yeah? I reading this the approximately 18 years old. Immediately reading, I feeling it's my life. Always, I pass through this stage in this moment. Yes? I in other side of the world. His ideas come in the German. Yes?
Yes.
So it's the ideas on the idea the kindergarten is existentialist, but it's our people. Yes?
I'm not sure what to say about what Heidegger really was about. I only ever enter him really by looking at particular texts. I don't think I ever will be ready to say, give a kind of a summary of what phenomenology is. Even every time I actually try and say what phenomenology is, I remember that whatever you say about it, it's wrong. It's got to be wrong. It's one of those things. Do you know? It's one of those subjects. If you try and make it explicit, obviously you've missed. Because you're always trying to point to something that you can't say. But there's an art to doing that, an art to pointing to what you can't say. But I'm already getting into the Bortoff lecture in a way, because he's trying to talk about that too. Whereas we're going to finish McGilchrist. And part of the lecture here is, you know, I just want to point again to the sense that when we're talking about the right brain, we're trying to point to something that we can't make explicit. That's the very crux of it. But that doesn't mean that we don't. There's a difference. Making something explicit is to bring it into focus. But that doesn't mean you're unaware of the background out of which things are emerging. But our awareness of the background is it's almost an attunement.
What's the saying in the Master and Cemetery? Can you tell me briefly what the plot line is?
Well, it's not a novel, it's
No, I know it's about
yes.
Two sides of the brain.
Yes. And it's. I can't give you a quick
synopsis,
but I guess that I'm hoping you're picking up something from what I'm saying now.
Yes.
So the left brain is the gist. I think of a quick synopsis would be the two sides of the brain don't take care of different. You know, it's not that language is on one side and logic is on one side and all of your artistic things are on the other. It's they're different forms of attention. And the left brain's attention is a focused attention. And the right brain's attention is a broad taking into account of the bigger picture, of the context. And they're operating together all the time. So it's not, you can't really sort of say, oh, we're all left brain people, because if you take the right brain away, you take the background out of which the left brain is drawing its material. But the gist of the book is that the left brain within itself has attempted to separate itself. The narrative almost of McGilchrist is that, like Toller, it's like Carl Jung. You know, there's a similar narrative in many different people that our task, if you like, is to come into a different kind of, yes, balance between these two aspects of our intelligence, that we aren't in one or the other, but that there's a middle synthesis that is possible to reach, and I think is possible to reach, and not in some enlightened state necessarily, but for anyone, you know, in moments, I think we all reach a certain kind of synthesis. It's just it passes.
Well, if people read the Foundation series by Asimov, I think that's also a bit. Did you read this? It's,
I might have done, but so many years ago. I read Asimov when I was at Warwick,
yeah.
18.
He kind of envisioned this structure where there is the known foundation, which is responsible for gathering all the information and creating this huge Encyclopedia Galactica that contains all the information that has been accumulated by humanity, where we're talking about humanity is already colonizing galaxies upon galaxies, and you know, we just this whole coming to a chaos. So on one hand, you've got this known foundation that centralizes all the knowledge and stuff, but then also there is this hidden one that's being created in a very far away place, which is more of this kind of thing, and those people there, they have the ability to telepathy and stuff like that, and that is by the soul fate, it's hidden, it needs to be hidden, those telepathic kind of abilities, and then it has to be separated and hidden almost from the main foundation. The main people on the foundation, they don't know the existence of the other ones, but in reality, yeah, they are in a way in control of
that. Yes, so I think it's almost, if you start getting the idea, you'll see the idea itself recurs in many different, it's expressed in many different ways, but there is some sort of, there's an imbalance in the human psyche. I think that everyone's more or less agreed on that. There's not many people saying it's all just fine as it is. In fact, that would be, although it is, at a certain, there's a certain extraordinary point of consciousness, I don't know if you've ever reached this one, where you just see it's all perfect. Have you ever been there?
You're
right. Yes.
Yes. The human interpretation.
No, I mean there's an actual moment where you just everything is just exactly as it has to be. I mean, I was thinking of it last week when I remember when I was much younger. You were talking about the world, weren't you? And you know. The blue canisters out there, and you know, Brexit, and you know, how could this all be okay? But there's a certain place where it's all perfect, and there's a great light illuminating it all. And I actually
after 16 points. Of
well, I won't go into that. It doesn't involve alcohol. You have
the
to
whole of no,
it's
not
no, it's, your head. No. But I'm just. There is a point of consciousness there where you, and it's quite high up there. It's not a stupid place. It's a place where you just see that the sun is reflecting off the windows in just the way that the sun has to reflect off the windows. That all of the blades of grass are exactly what they are, and they have to be what they are. And everything that's happening here is exactly perfectly. What it is. I don't know if that's that communication.
When you say this, I imagine the paradise.
Yes.
The perfect world.
Yeah, no, it's already here. It's already here.
But then that takes the
I've started it off now.
Yeah.
It's I've started it off now. Let's come back here. In fact, you just swallow that if you can. Just swallow that, because it's another one of those, you know, paradoxes. Do you know? Because I felt obliged to say that, because I was about to say there's an awful lot here, there's an imbalance here, something's wrong, and yet at the same time there isn't something wrong. I know it's a Barry Long day, so I'm gonna.
Depende of you.
Yes. But Barry used to say this a lot, and I just repeated, it's all right now. Always all right now. And now I know, and he just used to say that because he wanted everyone to start arguing with him, right? He'd say, no, it's not all right now. You know, but if finally, it's let's say. By saying it's all right now, it's only all right now if your mind utterly stops.
They always used to play that at the end of every disco in the 60s and 70s. All right.
Yeah, no, but that's not quite. It's not quite what the song.
I know, but
Free went, so it's all right now because I finally got her home to my bed, you know, isn't it? That's why it was all right now.
And it's all right now. Then it's all right in the entrance to the gas chamber.
Yeah.
As well.
No, that's what it means.
So if it's all right now, it's all right. All
yeah,
right.
Yeah. That's what it means. And if you're gonna read right deep into it, it has to say that the best thing that can happen to you is that you die.
Yeah.
But that takes quite a consciousness, doesn't it?
To the gas chamber with your kids.
Yep.
I don't know how you keep it at home.
And you just tell yourself that it's amazing and perfect.
You can't. Telling yourself won't work. You know, it's not a matter of a mantra.
You can't know how it is until you're actually the one going through the gas chamber. Mm-hmm. Put that heart toller in there.
Yeah, I know.
So we're back to language and power, and we were, if you remember, we were saying that in this evolution of language, we had this kind of musicality. And if you didn't see the Toller video, in a way, he was talking about it with the Golden Age, where we were, which was relating to Maturana, right? Maturana was talking about the Golden Age as well, but trying to put it in a biological perspective, where we were. In some sort of he wouldn't say pre-linguistic state. He would say we were still linguistic, but we had a different kind of language, a language that was more, as McGilchrist was saying, more of a singing to each other, and our language is entirely concerned with our communications with each other rather than the kind of language that we have now, that is a language of reference, that's that we use to organize our civilization. You know, the kind of civilization we have relies on a language that can refer to things that aren't present, not a language that's referring to our being together. You know, there's another kind of aspect of language that started to emerge much later than Maturana was talking about. And this slide here was just saying, and that's exactly you need this kind of language that grasps things and makes them specific and breaks things down and objectifies things. All of this is necessary in order for there to be anything like the possibility of organizing thousands of people together. Everything that comes with civilization, which, you know, is in Marx, wasn't it? And the specialization of labor. You know, that some people are out in the fields, some people are priests, some people are actually scholars, some people are making the shoes. You know, everybody gets their speciality because the entire system is able to coordinate in such a way that not everybody has to go and get their food, whereas in the hunter-gatherer world, it was much that sort of language and that sort of being together was only possible in a small group. The kind of language that you need to coordinate a large group of people is a different kind of language that brought this other side of the brain to the fore. Not that it wasn't there before, but it seems that specific syntactic referential language. If you look at the brain anatomically, it is in Broca's area and Wernicke's area, which are on the left-hand side of the brain, and they are situated near the part of the brain that's concerned with grasping with your hand. There seems to be a link here between that kind of attention that you need to grasp and manipulate things and pull things apart. There's also the language developed in that direction. And as it developed, you get that other narrative, which we kind of regard as the patriarchal narrative of the tool man, the toolmaker. You know, it's the right hand that makes the tools, but it's almost that the there's a reflection of that in the development of a new kind of language. But for us, in our history, we don't think of it as a new kind of language. We think, no, language actually started then. Well, you know, in what we've been looking at, we're saying, no, language, there was much more before that. And there was that, I mean, I still find it that great recognition of that our the true origins of language are in our loving communication with each other. And then there's the whole question of metaphor, because language can only really come into being according to the sort of solidification of metaphor, and metaphor itself emerges out of this broader attention of the right brain, which sees connections between things that aren't obviously connected. And when it's the harmony again. It's the right brain sees the connection between things that aren't obviously connected, and feeds that on to the left brain, that then starts to use the metaphor, and the metaphor then sort of loses its metaphorical, broad, poetic sense, and becomes a specific word that then just refers to something. Then you know, when a word becomes specific, the metaphorical aspect is lost, and we get the idea that a word is a thing that refers to something else. You know, because the word idea is a metaphor that Plato developed. The eidos was the look of something, the actual way something looks. And that had to be turned into, we've got a much different idea now of what an idea is. But all of these key words, especially philosophical words, were all originally metaphors, but metaphors become solidified by habitual use, and the left brain just chatters them out. So I better read the slide. I'm going to read the slides because I haven't looked at these since last week anyway. Only the right hemisphere has the capacity to understand metaphor. The word metaphor implies something that carries you across an implied gap. And McGilchrist has two ideas of a gap, two dimensions of gap here. At the top end, words are used so as to activate a broad net of connotations. In the philosophy of language, there's connotation and denotation. They're two. When something denotes something, that's when there's a strict reference between a word and the thing that it refers to, like the word "this table." My saying "this table" denotes this table, whereas a connotation is more like a word, how it is connected to many other things. So one thing, it's more to do with how a word is associated with other words.
John,
yeah.
Is it not true though that in every individual person, this how we hold language in our minds is up through schemata? So if you say the word rose, there'll be a schemata in my mind, in my head, all the connotations of that word.
Yes.
Will be very regulated by my experience and culture and so forth.
Yes.
And that will be slightly different to what's in her head.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So they're not. What I'm trying to say is that, is that what he's talking about? He's talking about the right brain way of looking at language, is to become aware of all the connotations and where they came from.
I mean, in a way,
like
becoming aware is an odd word to use it, because in a way the right brain is in a sort of it's hard to say that it's aware of anything, because what you're conscious of is what you're conscious of, and in a way that you become aware that the right brain had this bigger picture. Because it's something about its operation finally reaches your awareness. It's a difficult way to... I don't like to think that there's a right brain there that's aware of something that I'm not aware of. You know, there's only one awareness, really. That's consciousness now. But there's stuff going on in the background.
You can open up
yes.
to that.
And if you broaden your consciousness, then you see, oh, yeah.
And sometimes it's not verbally arrived. So, for instance, If, for instance, a word that normally has nice connotations for a lot of people, like, I don't know, sweetie or something like that, if that word triggers fear in me all the time, I become aware that for me there's another connotation that may be linked to the fact that, you know, I don't know, my dad called me sweetie every time he hit me across the face or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's what's coming up. That's the connotation with that. That didn't happen to me, by the way.
But you're into the Jungian thing here in a way that all these connections,
yeah.
There's a sort of a personal layer there,
yes.
About but it's particularly often it's to do with bad experiences as well there's a whole subject matter there, isn't there, where certain words are triggers, and in a way we're talking at another level here. We say, putting that aside, putting that aside at a deeper level, there's a sort of there are certain shared connotations that we have just by being members of the same language community, but even then that can be regional. Do you know there isn't a universal answer here, but there's a certain, you know, unification that's brought about by us all watching the BBC. You know, that was a great unifier of language for the nation. I'm concerned really now, given the day, you know, what the it's the media that's created the little England. You know, otherwise we would. I mean, my mum was in the world where the radio had just arisen. Before the radio, the press was about the only thing that kind of was able to give any sense that you're connected in a nation. But really, it didn't have the grip that our media has now in this creation of an idea of a national identity. But in a strange way, you see, it makes it. It makes a unified language that we all can't help but absorb, and there are certain connotations to words that the media creates, and then we all have it. It's strange, isn't it?
I suppose pre-media, then people would have folk tales that they hold in common, because you had strong national identity really, really far back.
But you've got.
What makes those people feel that they're all part of one?
Yes.
There must be the stories.
Yeah, yeah. No, the charge of the Light Brigade and all that stuff. You know, there were these narratives that you get taught as little boys at school that would create a sense of national identity, but you know that there are all these local dialects that were local states of consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what's being broken down, isn't it? and because what we're talking about, this, the connotations of our language, we used to be localized, but they're all spread out on the M25, up the M1, across the media. We're all
globalized.
Well, that's happening for those of us who done a lot of airline travel, you know, then an airport is a sort of an example of the world that we're heading for. You know, all the airports of the world are pretty much the same. So are university campuses, by the way. They're a little bit like airports. Everyone's just flown in. We're doing our research. They're not terrible places, university campuses, but and Brighton and London are, you know, there's a certain, because I'm banging on and saying, oh, it's a terrible thing, but at the same time, you really wouldn't want to live where, I don't think, in the true blue countryside around Brighton, would you? Yes.
I think there's a language to big cities too, that we perhaps use as a shorthand to make ourselves feel easier about being in different circumstances. So the idea that, you know, Starbucks will be in airports, you can often find British brands, you might be flying to the other side of the world, but you go via, I don't know, Dubai or something, wherever. But you might find shops that it might be a Costa, it might be, and it's almost a shorthand. Well, I normally, at this sort of time of day, I sit down and I have a coffee. And it's not a very good description, but I think we travel I don't think we're totally conscious, but we do a lot of the things that we do. We almost do them as if it's an habitual action. But we take ourselves at sometimes great distances to different cultures with different languages, with different scripts that we don't fully apprehend or know at times, but we use our own kind of shorthand to feel better about going to these places. Does that make a bit of sense?
Familiar with things?
Are
you feeling familiar with
it? Yeah, I think that sense of the familiar, it was almost even when Maria spoke about how language could be through a schmata through history and culture, I was thinking that you can sometimes pitch yourself, I do, when I'm in France, for instance, I try to say, okay, I can relate to my surroundings, I've got an understanding of the language, and I'm trying, when I receive that language, at the same time I'm trying to feel a tiny bit more secure and a tiny bit more familiar about it. And it's the same if I travel to places far away that I don't really know. I think sometimes I use a little bit of shorthand, because often I travel by myself. It's a bit of kinology to make yourself feel better about the distances that I'm traveling to, new environments. That's it.
Yes.
Can you explain this last?
I haven't finished at the top end. So I think we got as far as connotations, and I started talking about denotations, and then we went. Well, then we followed the connotations, followed them way out. Yes. So the connotations remain implicit, so that the meanings are appreciated as a whole at once, rather than being subject to the isolating effects of sequential narrow beam attention. As long as these meanings remain implicit, they cannot be hijacked, this is a word he uses more than once, by the conscious mind and turned into just another series of words or a paraphrase. If this should happen, the power is lost, much like a joke that has to be explained. So that's a good analogy, really, about how the background operates. If a joke's funny and it's properly funny, it's funny because, if you like, the right brain gets it, and the left brain doesn't. And it doesn't work. You know, a joke doesn't work. It rarely works on me now, because my left brain, it knows the punchline. You know, it's already... So there's no possibility for the right brain to to understand. You know, but that's the gist. It's a demonstration of your right brain intelligence, that it sees the joke, and it also it enjoys the fact that the linear one. I don't know if you know about your right brain, but it, in the background, it knows that it's more intelligent.
Yeah. I mean, they said that laughing is often about feeling superior, isn't it? You laugh out of superiority.
Well, you're feeling superior to your own, the other half of your own intelligence, because it's so plodding.
Yeah.
It just plods, one thing follows the other, and somewhere in the background, there's something that's way ahead, already ahead. I don't know if you get this. Unfortunately, I get this. You know, I often feel I'm in this place of being ahead of things. Anyway, we won't go into that. At the bottom end, this is the paragraph you were worried about, and I'm not sure what's in it yet. Every word in and of itself eventually has to lead us out of the web of language to the lived world. Remembering Husserl used to use this phrase, ultimately to something that can only be pointed to, something that relates to our embodied existence. Everything has to be expressed in terms of something else, and those something else's eventually have to come back to the body. To change the metaphor and invoke the spirit of Wittgenstein, that is where one's spade reaches the bedrock and is turned. There is nothing more fundamental in relation to which we can understand than that. I remember trying to write about this. If you look at language and you want to find out the meaning of a word and you pick up a dictionary, I'm thinking about this as a computer scientist, you know, because in effect a computer program, all it actually has is a dictionary. You know, it has to try and understand what you're saying by looking it up in a dictionary. But the thing about a dictionary is, if you look up a word, all you ever get is another word. Mm. You see, a dictionary is utterly circular within itself. It never leads out of itself to anything that isn't another word. How do you finally get out of this world of language? And what he's saying here. It's interesting, you might have got caught with the fact that he said it's the body. It involves the body, but I don't think everything leads back to the body, because every word that you use, for it to be grounded, finally has to be grounded in an actual experience. The thing about the way that we use language, though, is that many of our words aren't so grounded. They're often grounded in the promise of an experience. It's quite interesting to look into this, to what actual words and things that you express you could actually cash in. What a lovely metaphor, cash in, by the way, if you're looking for metaphors.
It's a bit like money and gold, isn't it? There's no gold behind it.
No, there's no, anymore. There is. There, you can't cash anything in. But what made gold valuable?
Yeah.
You know, that
incorruptibility.
You better hope the alchemists don't figure out how to make gold, because that'll be the end of its scarcity. Everybody holding the gold. Oh, it's right. Anyway, we won't go there. Gold is, it goes, it's not intrinsically valuable. It's only valuable, right, because of its scarcity. Do you see? So where's the value in the gold itself? It's not there. Just the shortage of it. But there's shortage of lots of things. So why would gold be the measure of value? Shortage is the measure. We come to Karl Marx, of course. In the end,
always be with me. Yes.
Labor is the.
With me, yes. The legend about the.
Midas.
Yes, about the
yes.
Man King, touch
yes.
Only conversion.
Yes. 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 The labour theory of value, if you know your Karl Marx, was it's all measured in the time that a human being bestows. It's human time is value. And it's not a perfect theory, but it's the only one that when I was studying economics, it was the only one that actually was a serious attempt to answer the question. Everything else was just sheer supply and demand. I mean, well, what are they? Ephemeral feelings. But so the gist here is that our language finally gets grounded out into experience of some form or other. And I was just saying, but a lot of our language, Pakistan, for me, as an actual experience, I've never had that actual experience. I take it on trust that there is such a country. You know, I'm just taking that as an example. But if you think of, if you just sort of survey your daily conversation, and you see how much you take on trust, it's most of it. The immediate sphere of your experience is connected to this, and it's the media and our education and Google and the internet and everything. We're connected to this enormous domain of all of human knowledge, and we don't really see the boundary between what we actually experience and all of this potential experience that we're pretty sure we could have. Do you know that the whole of the internet is full of things that you could buy or you could visit?
That's the premise of our economy, though, isn't it, as well? They have to keep on projecting forward into keeping you interested enough to buy more, or otherwise the whole rationale of it, of demand supply might disappear.
Yeah.
It goes further than that, because Pakistan doesn't have to exist, does it? It just has to exist between two people. The idea is to have a conversation about Pakistan. It might not exist, but that's
yes.
kind of irrelevant.
Yes.
So similar to gold. The value of gold exists between two people and not in itself. So gold doesn't have to exist to have value.
No.
This idea of it.
Well, no, but what's value? And again, you know, you see how language...
My ability to get you to do work for me, and then I do work for you. You know, if I've got gold, would you agree... exists.
Yes.
And we've agreed that I have more of it.
Yes.
And you want some of it.
But there's a level there, I feel Maturana would say, that was just a way that we coordinated our behaviour. It doesn't mean that the words meant anything.
Yeah.
It was our behaviours that actually were real. There's a way in which this referential language leads us off into... out of the pardon? Well, no, the gist is still connected, but let's say our ability to articulate goes away if we have a massive stroke and the left brain goes away. But the right brain's still fundamentally involved in our ability to understand the meanings of what we're saying. They're not both are needed. If you don't have the right brain, your ability to use language is impoverished because you lose the contextual understanding. So that you can't be an either or in thinking about this. The bedrock that Wittgenstein is saying is the bedrock of actual experience. And I'm just sort of emphasising here that, in fact, most of the time we don't actually test with the spade.
Yeah.
Do you know, we don't draw the distinction. Phenomenology is very much about this. Husserl, anyone who's done Husserl with me should remember. That's a very teacherly thing. You should remember. He draws a lot about this, you know, that we have a something we form an intentional object, and which in a way, in ordinary language, you have an idea of something, and there are many ways that that idea can have being in us. It can be just a pure word without any, you know, as you skim across a sentence, often you just use a word and you don't imagine what it is, you just use the word, knowing that it refers to something. You don't actually follow what it refers to, you just use the word, and you know that if you wanted to, you could follow the reference.
The children need a young people that there is a style. Using words, this little one using words cannot use it the old people. So you listen these words, you realize I don't understand, but I need starting to use it because she uses it. Or the other young people use it, you need interpretation this day anyway. Yes?
Yes.
It's happened.
But what I'm meaning here is that there are words are like promissory notes that you can cash in, but we mostly don't. But the actual experience of cashing in is that's only then does something become actual for us. And
does the process of interpretation?
The interpretation. I'm talking here about the idea I have of this phone.
Yes.
There's a certain level where the ultimate cashing in of this idea is for me to have it in front of me like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yes? That's as good as it gets. That's actuality for us. That's what it means. Mm-hmm. And you remember the whole phenomenological process. It's not just seeing it. It's that it has the right weight. It's that when I turn it, it transforms itself in the right way. That it's not... Is this a dagger I see before me? You know, it's not a vision. There's a whole...
So you said the same process, the phenomenology. You suggest an object.
Yes.
And
this is what the spade means, that it actually turns. Well, when you get the phone in your hand, the spade turns, if you like.
I understand.
Yes.
How would the spade turn in relation to words that describe, you know, like abstract nouns, for instance?
So, my... Yes. Well, when you can look into your experience as experience. You know, within the phenomenological reduction, you can say, well, there's a stream of consciousness here that's immediately present to me, and you could say the spade isn't really turning on an object there, but there's still a spade that turns that says, well, this is my immediate experience. Of feeling, I mean, let's be practical. If I'm feeling a bit warm, yes, and the spade turns on that. There's actually a corresponding feeling of feeling a bit warm in me now. When it comes to freedom, it depends what you mean by it, yes. But the idea of, I mean, there was you reminded me that somewhere in some cafe in India, I had an experience of just, I can do anything. I'm sitting here and I can do anything. I may go back to England. I may, you know, it's utterly up to me. But I know you can all say, you can say that. At any moment in your life, it's up to me whether whatever you do, it's true in every moment. But there was a moment then where I truly felt that the entire destiny of my life is in my hands. There's no power over me that is going to make me do anything unless I allow that power. Do you know, that's even my freedom. So there's a level there where you reminded me of that. That for me was I felt like I was in. I had a sort of a knowledge of the essence of what freedom is.
Apotheosis.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So I look back on that and I say, yes, I can still kind of you know, it's still in a way. So things have there are things like freedom. They almost have an essence. So it's not like the spade turns on something definite, but there are these things. I still say that there's something phenomenologically that corresponds to what freedom is, or paradise. You mentioned paradise. I don't know if anyone's had an experience of paradise, but these words, it seems to me, are indicative of certain states that it's possible to be in.
Yeah.
Yes? So there's a way the spade turns there as well. But not everybody... some of those words, they're pretty important words, and not everybody has necessarily ever encountered any sort of reality behind the word, in which case it's a kind of a word for which the spade doesn't turn, but we just use it in ordinary language. You know, I think there are a lot of words like that, and the way freedom is used, you know, in the United States, you know, when you say, oh yeah, when the United States stands for freedom, and everybody says, yeah, freedom, you know, it's just a kind of, it's a word with no, there's no ground that the spade turns on, you know. When you look into it.
So in the course of one's lifetime, you can't start your life from moments of this spade turning, because almost everything that happens to you is a turning.
I'm sure when you're this age, the spade's turning all the time.
Yeah.
You know.
And then you kind of accumulate more words and more ideas, and you start to kind of, you know, every time. It's kind of something new and something new, and then you get to your mid-20s, and at that point you kind of pretty much grasp the majority of what your human experience will give you, and at that point you feel, yeah, I'm in paradise, I can do everything, I'm in total freedom. But then what happens? Then you kind of start to have more and more references to, you know, you accumulate more past, isn't it? That the human life is you continuously accumulate more past for yourself, rather than, you know, if you had more future at some point, now you have more past. So you accumulate more past, more references to experiences that you had, or to knowledge that you gain, and you kind of, yeah, you know there's a Pakistan, you don't even need to go there, you know, you don't need to go to, you know, and then in terms of happiness, I think something kind of go over our, you know, how do you kind of mean, you know, accommodating past and maintaining the happiness that you have when you don't have something.
Well, that's
sorry.
Another question,
sorry.
Isn't it?
That's
a
dilemma.
There's
a dilemma.
Hello, Wes.
Do
I? No, I don't know, but probably about 12. Yeah, depending how it runs. Yes, is it, do you want me to do something at a definite time?
No, just
2 seconds.
Yeah.
I don't think
one for 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Anyone wanting to do a national qualification for free? They've been in the country for 3 years. Put their name down on this piece of paper for us, a telephone number.
Any old national qualification or a particular one?
All sorts of subjects. So anyone interested in doing and put a subject they want to, maybe a lot of related subjects. It's not practical, not like brickwork or electricity, but doing the wine industry, travel industry, business admin, anything like that.
Vocational, would we say vocational?
Vocational.
Oh, that's the word,
okay.
We're looking for, yes.
Not Spanish then?
Not Spanish, no.
Oh.
But any
art related.
You can do art, modern design,
yeah, okay.
Graphics, stuff like that.
Cool.
Anything vocational. So it's free, so if you want an interesting
where
get,
is it?
Here.
Oh, here.
You get it, but you have to do it at home on a computer, I think. You have to sign up here. They'll give you the thing to do on the computer at home, and then you get the qualification come through the post. You're not obligated to anything. It's all free, unless you don't complete the course, which is if you sign up for it, they send you lots of books. Hmm? Do you have to pay if you don't complete?
If you get the books, and you book.
I thought about this myself, you know, running a course that basically you only pay for it if you drop out. I thought that'd be a great way to keep up. It's free. You've just got to turn up. No.
Yeah. You have to complete because there's sort of.
It was 2 seconds. It was 2 seconds. So, because I think there's quite a lot more for people to know here, and I do want to finish the class. Oh. If you'll be around at lunchtime.
Well, if you're interested, leave your name and number there.
And ask Wes at
the
break.
And there's no books. There's no book. But it's free.
Which is a big thing.
Through here. Out of here is £300.
Thank you, Wes. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're just going back to music and gesture and language. And how this the early origins of music was more associated with what we would think of as dance, and the later development of language as we think of it as a syntactic,
what?
Verbal. Yes.
Okay. Maybe a bit embarrassing, but what's OCD cyber brain OCD related?
Well, I don't know. I'm not.
Is it right or left?
I don't know. So, I could only start. I just don't know. I'm not qualified to, you know, to say, and I don't think that McGilchrist goes into that.
It's like anxiety disorder, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean,
I don't think that it's understood, is it? I don't think it's part. It's not part of a definite. I know that in my own work, there's a lot of. Because I look into how the neocortex works, and this idea of the left and the right brain is generally ignored, you know, in the mainstream sort of neuroscientific understanding of things.
Really?
Well, largely ignored. So a lot of the. A lot of the thinking recently about different disorders is to do with an imbalance not between the left and the right brain, but between a kind of focus of attention that's predicting how the world is,
yeah.
And the actual information that's coming back from the world. So the sort of imbalance occurs where the brain can become too attuned to what's actually coming in through the senses and can't see the bigger picture. Or in another direction, you become too attuned to what you're expecting to see and you don't pay sufficient attention to what's coming into the senses. And a lot of things are... couched in terms of an imbalance between those two streams. But in relation to left and right brain, McGilchrist doesn't go into that. If he did, if you were here, you weren't here last week, it would all be on whether there's a correlation between people with OCD and any studies where parts of the brain have been affected, say with a stroke or with, you know, a part of the brain being knocked out, and whether that's...
Oh, I've suffered trauma and I fell on my head.
Yes.
Fell on my head as well. I had it before then, actually. I had it all my childhood. I had it,
So was a part of your brain damaged in that fall?
Probably was. I've never had it scanned. I think it's mildly scarred.
Yes.
No, because it hit my head while I was mildly dehydrated.
So I'm just not an expert in this area.
Yeah.
So, but I would, you know, you know, Google is an expert. You know, I think if there's been any research on this, it'll probably show up. But I'm not aware. The only things I was looking into autism and schizophrenia. The latest theories are looking at the imbalance between these incoming and predictive signals in the brain, but it's still only a theory. Do you see? There's the understanding of how the brain works is still in a very primitive state. How it works as a unity, you know. There's a kind of understanding about what the visual cortex is doing. But how conditions like OCD or autism or schizophrenia really involve the whole system, and it's not understood how the whole system interacts, so that you shouldn't treat any of this as fact. It's theory. It's still theory, and the entire left brain right brain theory is really built up on people with brain damage. You know what happens when bits of the brain are knocked out. Mm-hmm. So it's still... Do you see how that... It's not as if the underlying principle of how the brain works has been grasped.
Yeah.
We're trying to piece it together with bits of disconnected evidence. But it's still, I think, worth... looking into... these latest theories. They're still informative. But in a way, we have to treat them a bit like...
You're a neuroscientist.
Artificial intelligence I was in. So I was looking at... Yeah, I was looking at how the neocortex works because of... writing programs to simulate how the brain works.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's not artificial intelligence. I thought that would be intelligence. I thought that was just enormous intelligence.
Yes, well, there's another question. Yes. Yes. Yeah, I mean, in a way, you know, neuroscience now can call that branch of neuroscience calls itself computational intelligence and basically says the brain is a computer. But I would disagree.
Okay.
So back to music and gesture. We had this picture of the... if you like, the early development of language, which was before the left brain came into its own. I mean, this is the part of our narrative, in a way, before the left brain came into its ascendancy. The picture is that our language was more flowing and gestural and more related to what we already know as dance, to our expression of our whole body, but the development of our language starts to hone into the fingers and the hands, and the gestures start to become more grasping, yes, and more manipulative of parts and bits. And I think the idea being that this focusing on the hands and the grasping aspects of the hands and the tool-making manipulative aspects of the dexterity of our hands makes us more more focused on our individual capacities, our individual self, rather than our interactive self. The hand is a more separative in a way, unless it's a caressing hand, of course. We mustn't forget the hand's got its dual aspect. So the existence, I'm in the third paragraph, of a close relationship between bodily gesture and verbal syntax implies that it is not just concrete nouns, the thing words, but even the most apparently formal and logical elements of language that originate in the body and emotion. The deep structure of syntax is founded on fixed sequences of limb movement in running creatures. Now, I'm not sure exactly what he means there. I know that the logical, you know, the structure of logic is very simple. I mean, maybe you don't, but at the bottom of it, all the logical operators that you're generally taught are and, or, and not. But and that people often think of that the and the or and the not are somehow made up in heaven somewhere. but really they do emerge from a sort of the logic of way objects are present to us. The simple thing being that if the phone as a solid object is occupying that space, then this cannot occupy the same space at the same time. Yes, there's a logic of objects that says that two things can't be in the same place at the same time. So there's an either or in the very way that everything is presented to us.
Two things at the same density.
No, I'm talking about a solid object, you know, which I don't mean the logic of our science. I mean the logic of our bodies. Our bodies don't distinguish between oxygen and hydrogen. We distinguish between things that our hands can go through, gases, and liquids. Yeah, you can go through a liquid, but it's not like a gas, but a solid. There's a sort of there's a logic of solids, if you like. And the logic of solids, you can start to read into the logic of how solids are, becomes the abstract logic of what we consider to be logic.
I get that, but how is it founded on the fixed sequences of limb movements?
Yes. Well, and this is a point where I'm going to say, I'm not sure exactly what he means there either, Maria. In fact, if I'd have studied it more carefully, I would have left it out of my slide. I generally, if there's anything in there that, where I think I'm not quite sure what that means, I generally leave it out of my slide. But yes. But in this particular case, I'd only start riffing. You know, I can always make up what he might have meant, but I'm not sure. I'm not exactly. Yes, I'm not sure how the deep structure of sin. I can feel something starting to make up. He's talking about verbs.
Doing,
yes.
Subject doing object.
Yeah, here we go.
Subject doing object. One leg moves up to another leg and you're running. I don't know.
Why wouldn't it have been like something, some other physical process, like eating or picking your nose? I mean, why running?
But it's a fixed sequence, isn't it?
Fixed sequence.
I mean, I think ultimately what he means is that the same kind of brain processes that control the motor cortex, that basically send messages down the spine, structure our sentences. But that's what he means. But in order for that to make sense, you have to say, oh, well, here I am walking. And here's a sentence that corresponds to the way that I walk, and I can't quite think how exactly they are connected. I feel like one of those, you know. I remember back at university, what my stock answer to this was. But you can research that, Maria, and come back to us next week. That soon stopped people asking questions, difficult questions. No, yes.
Maybe just try to sound
yes,
clever.
Yes. So, at the bottom, I think we do understand reason is evolutionary in that abstract reason builds on and makes use of forms of perceptual and motor inference present in the lower, quote, animals. So we reason and infer about the future in the very structure of our perception and action, and so do dogs and cats. Of course, you can see that. You can see dogs are reasoning about the consequences of doing something. So the whole structure of what we consider to be reason is already, you can see how that is embedded in the way that our perceptual, our very expectations about what's going to happen next are structured on cause and effect. Cause and effect, and our process of reasoning is just an abstraction of our the way that we've already evolved to perceive and behave. And there's something interesting in that, because it is evolutionary in a way. Because our behaviours and our perceptions actually conform in some way to the way the world is, we've survived. Yes, that's why our reason, if you like, is works. It works because we've survived, and in that sense, it's a correct reasoning. If our reasoning were incorrect, then we wouldn't have survived. If you like, all the creatures whose reasoning was incorrect didn't make it. So nature is sort of in that sense, has evolved our reason. All that we've done is we've managed to make it an abstract reflection of that in our minds.
And also, if you can't move, you don't need to reason. There's no point in you reasoning or grasping anything. This is why plants don't invest in brains. Because what use would it do if you can't then translate it into...
I feel there's a whole... I was waiting for the plant.
I know.
There's a whole bunch of people here who's going to defend the plants.
Yeah, but it sounds like...
I
know that there's... New researchers show that they kind of fear and respond to things, but it's like if you take the vegan thing that it's not right to kill an animal, but it's okay to kill a broccoli, because the broccoli doesn't feel pain, and you know we know that when we cut our fingernails, we don't feel pain because there's no nerves, so there's no nerves. No nerve system, no investing energy in the maintenance and operation of a nervous system. I mean, we do know that there is some nervous system in plants, but it's kind of, we assume that it's not feeling pain, at least. So it's kind of like pain and perception and stuff like this, they're only necessary if you can do something with them.
Yes, if you have motility is the word that they use.
So
it's with motility that you get nervous systems. Motility, the ability to move, it involves the development of nervous systems that in some sense attempt to see the consequences of the movement. And so seeing the consequence of movement is the beginning of reason. Whereas you would say a plant is more in an immediate stimulus response state, where but I think the more we learn about plants, the more we'll find that there is a certain amount of prediction in the way that the plant behaves. But the distinguishing thing is this, the idea of an independent nervous system within the body that is concerned with controlling what we would call voluntary behaviour is the hallmark of what we would think of as the beginning of reason. And we're at the where whatever's happened in us with our brain, we are able to reflect that reason into our intellect now. And the consequences are all outside the window there.
So is he ultimately saying it's movement that equates with modes of reason, which is perhaps linked to survival?
Yeah, I mean, they're all connected together.
Because is that not the beginning of that last paragraph? The same neural and cognitive mechanisms that allow us to perceive and move, so that's the neural, our system, around also create our conceptual systems and modes of reason.
Yes. So, I mean, this is a bit more in my own area. So, our ability to perceive something, and this would be true for the mammals as well, anything with a cortex, involves our ability to predict's maybe even the wrong word, but in a way we're continuously predicting what it is we're perceiving, and that ability to predict it says that we already have the form of the thing that we're perceiving in us. And having the form of the thing that we're perceiving already in us is to have a concept.
So is the prediction the movement?
Well, this is an interesting question. The way that the current thinking is that our movement is a prediction about how the world is going to change. And it's got a side shoot, because a perceptual prediction just predicts how the world's going to change, and you think nothing's happening in the body. But in fact, our perceptual prediction is always a prediction about how the world is going to change when I shift my eye, when I turn my head. So all of our predictions about it's about how things are going to appear include the body. Because the body's always moving, the body's always adjusting.
But is that the gross, the moving of the head? Is that the gross, you know, the later aspect?
Because no. In the idea of this prediction, the prediction is going to predict that you're going to turn your head, and that prediction that you're going to turn your head becomes the motor signal that turns your head. So we've got all these predictions firing down through the brain. Some of them can't change things, and ineffective. It's no good predicting that the phone's going to be there unless I move it. But if I predict my hand's going to be there, it happens. So some predictions have actual effect, and others you discover in a way looking from the brain's perspective that some predictions actually change the world and others don't. And the predictions that change the world, you recognise, that's my body. Yes, that's the domain over which, if your predictions that have efficacy, then that becomes you. And if your predictions aren't effective, you're utterly dependent on the what's coming back, and you can't change it except by means of your body, then that's the world. Do you see? So it's all prediction, but some of your predictions actually have the power to change the world directly. And then you've got this sphere, this domain where you hold sway. It just happens. If you get the feeling of it, it's amazing. You know, the voice just comes out, the jaw's moving, the whole thing. I can think the phone doing a flip, it don't move. If I can think my hand doing a flip, I'll just send a message to something over there that will make my hand flip. It just does it. That's me. So do you see how that's me?
It's intentionality, is that?
But listen, you see, the intentionality that you have that holds sway over the body, how remarkable it is, and how obvious it is, you know, the difference.
Except that sometimes it doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah. And it can get messed up, right? People, I mean, you know, if you read McGilchrist, there are people with strokes who get the feeling that it's not their arm. You know, like really weird disassociations going on in the body where you no longer think that, or again when you get thoughts in your mind and you think that's not me. Do you know when the predictions go wrong?
Or amputees who think they've still got their leg.
Yeah,
that and feel the pain. Yeah, when he was having a stroke.
Yeah. Yes.
So is it that, well, I've always been intrigued by the idea, and people voice this, after they're said to have had a stroke, they'll be speaking in a different accent. I don't know if you've heard this on the radio and stuff, or seen it on TV, where someone has a stroke, has got a kind of received pronunciation, accent, or whatever that can be, and then all of a sudden they're speaking English but with an Italian accent. But that's post the stroke, it's not something that they've put on.
Was there some strange I mean, I remember I had a girlfriend who, you know, whenever she lost it with me, she would, she'd be Scottish. But she'd been brought up in Scotland, you know, in her earlier life. So it suddenly...
I think she's going back more to a primal state when she wanted to make something more decorative.
Yes.
I don't know. But the body has to... The body will adapt to changes. So you spoke
about... But I've heard of people speaking... another language after coming out with the language they've never learned.
There's weird stuff that can happen here. So, like, I think with Frances, she actually had a Scottish accent earlier in her past, but there are examples where people seem to get something from the psyche that couldn't have come from their past, where it's a bit more mysterious, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not mysterious, I mean, for us it's mysterious because we don't, as a culture, we don't think... anything can happen unless there's a physical cause. Can I spin through? Because I definitely want to finish these slides before we have our lunch. So, this slide is about how we learn to speak by imitation. And imitation isn't quite the same. Again, there's always a left and right brain distinction where there's an attempt to copy by rote, which is a sort of a left brain, I must focus on this and learn each individual step, and then I have to try and put all the steps together. And then there's a form of imitation where you, in some sense, attempt to inhabit or attune yourself with the person that you're imitating. I don't know if you ever, you know, try and put on an accent. I don't know if I can do that now, but you know how it is. You have to kind of feel your way into something before you can really do it properly. You're following me. And then after a while, you might just get in the stream of it. You know what I'm saying? There's a difference that you're not doing it like, oh, I just remember how to say that word and that word and that word. There's an attunement that goes on. Yes. And in a way, you have to be, especially if you imitate another person, you have to develop a certain affinity with them.
It's literature, doesn't it? If you're reading out loud.
Yes.
It can happen. But you're like Jane Steinbeck called.
Yeah. You found it really easy to speak. Yes.
I think with foreign language, you do that to a certain extent. If you're in another culture, it's another environment. You're sensing that something's different, and then with words and people that you're speaking to, you want to be included in the group, but thinking about that idea where just of imitation, I think that being, I do like football, and I think you have, Steve McLaren was an English manager who went to Holland, and then he attempted, he was still speaking English, but he was doing it in a Dutch accent, and there's another footballer who went and played in France, but he was imitating, but just by changing his English accent. That's not the true imitation, but just goes to show that we attempt to do it, even if we know that we're not actually making it.
No, but you do. You know how it is. I mean, especially if I'm around a Scots... I don't know why the Scots are getting it today, but if I'm around a Scottish person, I will start to speak back to them a little bit like this, you know, and you can see that it's not going down well, you know. But I almost can't help it, you know, there's something about I like this, the lilt of the Scottish accent, you know. I feel it's almost I'm paying a compliment, but you do it subconsciously, and what the slide is talking about is how as children This is how we learn to speak. How amazingly good children are at it as well. I mean, speaking of Dutch, a friend of ours was Dutch but had an English husband, and there I was there when their little girl was, you know, about three, and was just jumping between these languages. It's just as easy as pie, you know, perfect, no problem. There seemed to be a kind of a sponge-like capacity to absorb language around that age. I think there is. It's part of the, you know, there's a right time to get language. If you don't get language at all, I mean, they've done studies on this. I remember in studying philosophy of language myself, they love the horrible case. There was a girl who, in California, I think, was locked up in a cupboard and never learned to speak. And when she was finally released, in her teens, she had to be taught how to speak again, and she never got it fully. You know, there was still like when you're speaking another language, you kind of have to think, how do you say that? She was caught in that. She had to think about how to speak because she didn't get it at the right moment.
Is that to do with the human, lack of human interaction as well?
Yes.
I'm going by an experience I had with an Arabic friend. They ran a shop, and I used to go into the shop, and they would speak to each other. They'd carry on this conversation. And after a while, I was just standing there. I started understanding what they were saying, and I would check it out. Were you talking about this? And she'd say, yeah, how do you know? And I'd say, well, I was just getting the sense of what you were saying.
Yeah. So we're getting the sense now slowly, right? So there's a right brain kind of aspect here where that's how you pick things up, and it's very different to sitting in your French class at school, you know, declining the verbs. You know, you get the difference, and yet it seems to be in a later life that's what you have to do. I've got to learn the vocabulary, and although I suspect that if you just go and live in France for long enough, you can avoid all of that.
My French cousins, I've got three cousins that were brought up in France by English parents, and their father was like a Cambridge don, so spoke very, very English, really English, you know, like from, and they all have French residency, and they speak very fluent French, you know, they're French, so there's a whole, you know, like they are French. And yet when they go to English, they're really English.
Yes.
They speak very English. You know, they speak their father's English. So they're amazing. They're wonderful. Really.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great to
and
see.
And they flow through it together.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously when they're together, not, you know, they just stop. They go into different, you know.
You almost
English
catch it.
But how do you see them? Do you see them any differently when you're looking at their English self as opposed to their French self? Because you've already described your uncle there.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
When you see the English side, but when they speak French, do you
they're
no,
French.
I think I still relate to them a little bit in English.
Okay.
In their but I see them as very continental.
Right.
Because they are.
Yeah.
They're so French when they're French. They really are. They're just, you know, and of course they're
you
French.
See how it makes us laugh?
Because
it is. It's like.
It's
you sort of think, we're such amazing things.
Yeah.
You know, we've got such capacity.
They flitter around with each other in French and English. They go into English and they're just so English with each other. It's wonderful.
But you almost catch the kind of, that it's a game. You know, English John. It's just a kind of a, you know, you can peel it off and you can become something completely different and then switch back again. But we... You know, we tend to get so fixed in our one mode, don't we?
I remember my partner, she speaks fluent Italian, but I didn't realise she lived on a night. And I remember, first time I ever heard her speak, she was on the phone speaking to an Italian friend, and she switched into fluent Italian, and I was like, who are you?
Yeah, yeah.
Who is this person?
Who's this?
Italian accents and mannerisms.
Yeah, that's right. That
yeah.
a new whole new thing comes up, doesn't it?
You have a talk about it.
Yeah. That's right. She could probably have another boyfriend, you know.
Yeah.
And they would if you could both handle it. If you could both handle it, it wouldn't interact, you know, because there's two. Anyway, we won't go there.
It's quite distinct to the whole, you know, the family, they interact.
So that, and the I mean, there's the whole, at the bottom of the slide there, there's this deeper sense of, you know, how as children we don't just absorb the language, we absorb the entire worldview of the people around us, you know, like the sponge. There's nothing you can do about it. You get your mum and dad particularly, it's later you might say, you know, I didn't want it, but it's too late. you've got to deal with it. Or maybe it was good. I mean, I don't say it. Yes. And that's all about this aspect or dimension of language being embodied. And how this original, deeper level of language that we're talking about, this part of the talk is all about the language in the background, the right brain aspect of language. McGilchrist is saying, and this reflects back to Maturana, that in a certain way, if we pull back from when it becomes a manipulative, referential, factual affair and just becomes a communication between people, that it's a kind of, it sort of flows out of the body, but the words, instead of my actually touching you, I'm reaching you. Especially if you're in a loving place with somebody, your words are actually like a caress. And the thinking being here that, of course, the higher apes spend hours grooming each other, in a way, and that whole just touching each other and grooming each other is a kind of a bonding. That our talking together is like that. Only we don't. It's not. We don't actually have physical touch, but in a way, it's a psychic. You know, like now. You know, you're more. In so far as you're listening to me in a sort of a receptive way, it's, do you know, we're, it's like a form of touch, isn't it? Only,
well, it's positivity, isn't it?
Yeah.
In terms of, I think it's a great sharing tool that we have. Just as how you can, you know, take being a bit more negative here, because you mentioned about factual and manipulative, you see how politicians answer questions. They don't answer the question, or they're not really wanting to share with you some kind of knowledge. It's more to try to, they've got their own separate lexicon, and it's about, sometimes it's about exclusion or the power of the manipulation.
Yes, I mean, we were talking with Maturana really about that, and the politicians, the way that they use language is exactly as you say. It's defensive. It's an utterly defensive, closed, contained, controlled, absence of that. You know, that was the thing to begin with Jeremy Corbyn. He hadn't learned to speak like that.
Yeah, not that
kind. Yeah, so he actually was saying stuff like that was just only what he thought, you know, and into the domain of political discourse, and that he really reflected back to me. Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, every now and then I can't bear it anymore. But you know, you learn. There's a little handbook. So it happened in the 1980s. You get asked a difficult question, you don't quite know how to respond yet, so you say, look. And that, just by saying look, that, you know, I'm sure it's in the handbook, you say a word like look, and that gives you another 2 seconds or so.
Or just to make it clear.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, yes. You've got a whole bunch of phrases. And
it makes you the authority.
Yeah, and after you've said look, and you've given a sufficiently dignified pause, you can actually ignore the question. You know, because you can rely on the dear audience has an attention span of about 1 second. Mm. You know, so if you can break that, I mean, it must be. I don't know. Must it be, or does everybody just? I mean,
No. I think it's true. I think there's a whole, it's obfuscation, it's distraction. Mm. There's a lot of stuff there.
Just answering the question you want to ask, just bringing it right back to what you want to say.
I mean, it's there's a certain level, I think, for a lot of people where you think, well, what's happened here? What has happened here? I would imagine that a lot of the politicians feel the same. It's I don't think that they love it, speaking in that way. But if they don't, you've got the press that will take anything out of context. You know, I know what they're doing. They're editing what they're saying because they're thinking about every single sentence and how it could be taken and manipulated and changed. You know, so we get the. I mean, I like to say for the dear politicians that we get the politicians that we deserve, collectively.
It's another language game, though, isn't it, with a very specific set of rules?
Yes.
Like the interview, the question time performance, especially from a politician.
Yeah, but I mean, Trump and Johnson are sort of playing with the boundaries of just telling lies and see what happens. And they're starting to discover, oh, yeah, nothing happens.
That's what's terrifying.
Yeah,
nothing happens.
It's all right. And, you know, because a lot of politicians, if I just tell a barefaced lie, you know, the people will at least see that. But no, barefaced lie, as long as it agrees with what you already think. It's offensive to say something that I think is a lie.
Shocking that there's no process that they can get sacked or removed.
Well, or when there is, it doesn't seem to be.
Well, like with Trump, yeah.
But it's fully. If given that a lot of politicians would be lawyers in the first place, it's interesting that they don't want to follow the full process.
Yes, but we'll back out of that area of public life where you can see that. Historical processes are at play, if you like. You can certainly see it. There's a degeneration of political discourse, and it was pretty poor to start with. You know, you didn't think you'd miss Harold Wilson, but you know, anyway.
Does McGilchrist say anything about the impact on the other? So the politicians, you know, I often think they're having an impact on us. They're impacting themselves because something is happening to. You know, it must be that in not being authentic, they're disassociating. That you know, so I'm thinking of us as humans. What is it doing to them? And I'm only speaking for myself now, in that I can be washing up and I'm hearing this. What's it called? The obfuscation or whatever. It's having an impact on me.
Angry,
you know, it's affecting me, even though I know it's a lie, I know what they're doing,
but
it's affecting me emotionally,
and
I don't know the impact of that effect.
Well, it's the sort of, it's,
you know, long term,
yes.
That's what I'm saying, it's having an impact on us, and then you hear the amount, you know, the increase in mental illness, and the increase, it's not just the physical aspect of, you know, the benefit. Policy
yeah, yeah.
or whatever. It's that day-to-day impact.
Yeah, it's wearing you down. And that's right. And we're not hearing... there's no... The stream is so... There's such an absence of integrity and honesty in it that it wears you down, doesn't it? It's I mean, to the point now where I can't really listen to it. I mean, because it's like you say, it gives you a kind of a view on life, and if you tune into it, you start to become attuned to the frequency on which it's broadcasting. Whereas we can do better than that, can't we? But no longer in our public life is that seem to be possible. We the only place we can do better is in forums like this. But these at least aren't being. Yeah, Wes, you want me to finish, but I can't. I haven't finished yet. It's so. We'll say that was about grooming and about how language has an emotional tone to it, and we were really bringing out the emotional. There's an emotional tone to our political language and our media language that is distressing for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's like instead of being groomed, it's like we're being, you know, something not so nice is being done to us.
Grooming.
Yeah, it's an unpleasant.
Mm-hmm. Grooming is to feel helpless. I can do this and you can do nothing about it.
Or you can turn it on its head. And I think what was good there was about the idea, though, about attuning to a frequency of things like this, where it's the positive engagement as opposed to that inauthentic. You can put it to the side. I think to a certain extent, in our, just like we spoke about, how you don't need to. Given that we've got a division of labour and not everyone is having just to rush out and grab food, you know, we have different jobs. One can be the bus conductor, one can be the lawyer, whatever. We don't have to totally buy their brand of language. We can remove ourselves a bit. I think turn off the radio is one. I can get very caught up in. But I think part of it is that if that emotional charge that you're getting, that negative emotional charge, either you fight and you resist and you want to hit back, yeah, that's one thing in terms of resistance movements and all the rest of it. It's like to say that power I'll take on, or alternatively you kind of think they're not on the same frequency, and perhaps just concentrate on people that are.
Yeah,
more
I mean that's if you want to know my political thinking, that's sort of that's about where my political thinking is. If the only the frequency of intelligence is what it is, right? And you can't blame the politicians for the general level of the frequency of the intelligence of the entire nation, you know, which is a bell curve, you know, in the middle of the bell curve is not. Well, you know, I don't need me to describe it, right? We had. I don't want to bring Brexit in, but Brexit's an example, if you like. And you can say, oh well, that was all. The people were all manipulated, and they're all basically good. But essentially, I don't see it that way. I see everybody in each one of us is responsible for the frequency of our own intelligence, and. If you have to look at your own life and say, well, in any situation where I'm dumbing down the frequency of my intelligence, then I'm submitting, if you like. And in any situation where I'm actually able to you know raise the frequency a little bit, then that's good, you know, because the only possibility here is that bell curve frequency. Shifts in the right direction. Possibility of what? We're back to the beginning of the lecture in a way, which is the idea. Oh, and it's all going to shift, and we're all going to end up in paradise.
Yeah.
But maybe that's not what the planet's for. Maybe the planet's just for a hand. I just like to put it to you: a handful of people to wake up.
Because we haven't got the tools or using the tools to tune them, John. They're available to us. Tools to attune.
But the tools have to be. People have to freely engage, don't they?
If language and all of that came. There's a need to coordinate all the nations and all of things.
Yes.
And language is needed for empires and all of that. So we kind of, you know, we're now in the left hemisphere kind of realm of, you know, we're going to use language to control the empire, and we're going to use language and political discourse to maintain the empire and to maintain the richness of the billionaires of society and the millionaires of society. You know, and the bigger the gap becomes, the bigger the need to manipulate and to lie and to hide and to pretend to be, you know, caring about the people, where in effect we know that all you're really caring about is to maintain what you've got, you know, and to have as little interference from the people to take away from you what you've got, because you've now amassed so much riches that, you know, before technology you couldn't amass, you know, you could amass a little bit of riches and you could have been a little bit, you know, richer than your neighbor, but you couldn't have been a billionaire speaking to somebody in Africa, for example, you know, which is beyond, you know, you are now amassing the riches of all of Africa, you know, a group of people. So it's kind of like, well, because of this process of the ability to extract more and to concentrate riches more, which is what technology is enabling, we are, and unfortunately I think we're not going to, you know, the sick people right there with all this mass, with their addiction to power, they are becoming very sick. And we do need to differentiate ourselves from them and move away from them.
So I'm very hesitant. This is why, because I was getting a lot of emails from Jeremy Corbyn at one point, you know, about the billionaires. I'm very hesitant about that finger that says it's the rotten old billionaires, they're to blame. You know, it's very close to the Jewish bankers, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Billionaires come from all walks of life, aren't they?
No, I know, but we're still holding a certain group responsible for the state the world's in. Whereas, I mean, I've got to be Maturanaistic about this. We're living within a certain kind of system, and the system is going to produce billionaires. Yeah, that's the nature of the system, and the system is, forget about the ecological system, the actual economic system is quite fragile. It may not look fragile, but it's fragile. You think of the financial, the global financial crisis. That was a sign of the fragility of the global economic system. Now, the global economic system although it may not feel like it, it's in a state of unstable equilibrium. It's still functioning. And it, in order to function, there have to be billionaires, there have to be poor people being ripped off, there has to be China producing all these goods extremely cheaply because it's industrializing. The whole structure of the way that it's functioning, it's got an internal logic which isn't being directed by a conspiratorial group of billionaires, even though they will get together, the people with the money, to try and keep the system running. I'm only saying that the system itself,
yeah, I wouldn't say that to the degree that they've kind of, you know, premeditated the situation and they've led us here, and they still, you know, they don't have, they are results of the system, as much as
unconscious processes that,
yes,
you know, it's a result of, you know, the, of.
But what I mean is, if we consciously, as people who think, you know, we don't like this discourse, we don't like this whole thing, we would like a leader to be really one of us, really, you know, able to express his own fragility and his own doubts in life and all of that.
It would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yes. So how do we kind of, what can
somebody, the Prime Minister, guess, well, I don't know, not really. You know,
I think what was said earlier by John has got some truth about, you know, how Corbyn, when he did come to power, for instance, and you could see it in Question Time, he had a very different. He didn't have the smoothness and the polishness of Cameron. He hadn't had that education, and so in a way, he wasn't able to use the same cues that the media and the people were picking up on necessarily. How he was dressing, or how he was expressing, or what terms he was using, etc., etc. But I thought what was it, and his other, he so he reverted to a very different way, as some say, this is the problem, I've got it written down. Mrs. P in Birmingham says that the streets aren't clean. What are you going to actually do about it? At a very concrete, basic level. But it wasn't enough for this very shiny, materialistic world that we live in for people to really take to that, and never mind just thinking about the brand, because there are different brands of politics. So in terms of that authenticness, if you do put yourself up for that, you can really get massively lampooned in our system.
So we're really going to get through.
And Wes is there too.
Yeah.
Very bold.
So we're just going to say about singing. Yes. And what a remarkable thing it is, and how we sing in choirs and we sing in harmony. How much we love it. How amazing human song can be. And it's not individualistic generally, although, I mean, it can be. But there's an aspect of human music where it's unifying. And then there's an argument there that says the development was a kind of a part of evolution, because it created a group unity that was helpful for the group to survive. And he's going to argue against that in a moment. So in this idea of evolution, that Maturana in his way was arguing against, that evolution being the survival of the fittest, the only reason that we were loving is because the loving group survived. And they were only loving for as long as we were in small groups, and then when the small group mode of being was overcome by agricultural civilization, we stopped being loving because we formed a new system. I guess the gist of what Maturana is saying, and maybe something that we're saying here, is that we still know of this. It hasn't gone away, this loving way of being together. I don't know how we know about it, but it's there. You know, when we were talking about how we feel about when we listen to the politicians, it's almost as if the hunter-gatherer is listening to that, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Do you know that we don't just go along with it? One of the things I think we should recognise, and this is across not just a little select group of people, but it's across the country, everybody is disturbed by it, really, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Do you know, there's a part of the brain. Mm-hmm. One thing you should see about our society, because we've been looking at the bad, is that we know that we could do better, don't we? Do you know, there could be another civilization where everybody says, great, I want more for me, and that's all I care about. But we don't live like that, actually. We're exceedingly disturbed by the way things are going on, because we have something there in us that recognizes our capacity to live together harmoniously, cooperatively, and in a loving way. And we don't have any real empirical evidence for that, do we?
Well, there haven't been big Brexit parties, have there? Hasn't been, as
no,
far as I
really
know.
Interesting.
Has there been a massive kind of happiness?
Well, not
in the streets?
Not, maybe in Warsaw. You haven't been up north, have we?
Boris hiding away. Boris, he knows he's ashamed. He knows.
No,
because he's not been out.
You know, but that's
boasting.
I mean,
but no, let me bring it back. No, let's leave Boris. Please leave Boris.
Yeah,
I want to remind us how disturbing we find it, because we seem to have a knowledge of a different way of being together that's has come to us from the past as well, from the deep past. And my sense that one of the reasons why I take Maturana seriously is because I feel that it's the deeper in us is this capacity for cooperation and unity. Where's that come from? You know, because I'm talking about, let's have a little trip down history, you know, and what's actually happened. We've been living in this divisive state ever since it's been recorded, and yet we still have a sense, I think all of us have a sense, even Christianity. Christianity had this in it, didn't it? And it's the, if you like, the higher frequencies of Christianity had this this idea of universal love. Where do we get that from? It wasn't just something that some priest chatted in my ear, not for me.
I think it's a bit of an ideal, though. I mean, if you have a look at...
What does that mean, though, phenomenologically? Because I'm saying something like, I wouldn't say it was an ideal. I would say I sense that we have the capacity here, now, not at some future date.
Well, in any small group, any communes that get together and try and live together and all that, there's always like eruptions.
Yes. Now I'm with you, and I know, Maria.
Not all sweet
you have
as a light, is it?
No, that's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is it's not all Boris Johnson. I'm counterbalancing that. I'm not saying it's all sweetness and light. I'm saying, but where have we got this other sense?
I think it's good that it has been passed down. I just wonder if somehow it's still being able, despite very big institutions existing. You mentioned about how universities might be in terms of their in the look of it, but in actual the feel and the practice, especially when it was free, and that was probably the same word. Is that there was a togetherness with, whether it be the people in your immediate class or with the lecturers, there was a communication, there was something that was going on. So I think, and it's the same with ideas, and it's learning different about seeing these ideas that I think keep something of that spirit going on. And it doesn't just come from, but also it's embodied in families or communities, you know, how that might be expressed in how people live. Shared housing, or people do have to, you have to do it with a certain amount of goodwill and positivity, or otherwise it really doesn't work, does it? It really does go to the fact that where the communes are at one
another.
No,
yeah, and I mean, I'm with you, Maria. It's all failed. All of these attempts to live in a different way. I won't say it's all failed, but because that's wrong. I'm wrong to say that, but it hasn't taken off.
I think it's failed because people don't accept that we're arsey creatures. You know, we do get on each other's nerves, and that's fine. I think it's when you've got this ideal of all living in harmony that's the problem.
I think that it's not exactly like this,
yeah.
Because if you look at, I mean, we're talking from a Western civilization perspective. If you go to villages in Africa, okay, of course they have the disputes,
yeah.
Of course they would have stuff.
Yeah, they know how to resolve them.
But as a whole, you can't resolve it. Life goes on, you kind of resolve it, whereas, you know, and in a way, if you look for a successful people living together, you don't look, you kind of, it's us and our enclosed kind of thing that we think that we are separate, you know. If you live and you have very little and stuff, when you're kind of with your neighbor and doing stuff, then it's a different form
of
experience.
So that's what I'm not arguing against that.
So I'm going to finish this class, all right? I'm going to finish this class. Values and choice. I just want to let you know that McGilchrist is at the end of this chapter. Of course, you know this because you all read it. Was saying that this argument of utility from evolution that says that the only reason that we developed loving behaviours was because it was of utility for our survival, and the point, I guess, that he's making here is a humanitarian point, is that human intelligence has reached to a point where we don't have to be determined by utility anymore. This is something to do with his idea, which he doesn't argue for, but he feels is true, that our intelligence has reached a point where we have the freedom to choose how we live. It's not a matter of utility anymore. And even if our ability to live together to a certain degree in harmony is something that we evolved in order to survive in harsh conditions, we now have arrived at a place where we have a certain freedom to look at how we might want to live together. Maria, you know, I think you're sort of saying that this conflictive aspect of human nature is just that, human nature, kind of imposed on us, and we just have to accept it. I just like to like at the beginning of the lecture, I would just like to say, well, I'd like to leave that open. What's possible for us? It's still early days for humanity. We haven't been able to handle that conflictive aspect of our natures well up until now, but that doesn't mean that we have to sort of. I don't think we've got to the bottom of the psyche that's producing this behaviour. You know, the attempts that we've made have, if you look back on it, at communal life, have been very superficial and not really informed, by our best psychology and our best philosophy and our best intelligence. I don't think we can, you know, I've been a member, we tried a bit of communal living ourselves, but it was childish. What I was involved in, just childish. A kind of a childish hope that we just all throw ourselves together in a house and dedicate ourselves to, you know,
some bloke.
Mm-hmm. It'll all turn out all right if we just throw away our self responsibility and let somebody else take care of it for us. Which in many, I don't think there's been that many really serious attempts for people to. Attempt to live together.
You have an authority figure.
Yeah.
Because it's in our culture that you have to have someone who knows all the answers. So you can express communal living by having someone who knows all the answers, and that's why it doesn't work.
Yes. But it does. I mean, one of the things that has troubled me, I guess, is in this mental realm, which is a left brain realm, where it's almost inevitable that you will finally, if you put a bunch of people together, there will finally come about some kind of disagreement that goes deeper than just who did the washing up. You know, there's some kind of the conflicts that arise between human beings. I mean, I understand this, Maria. They can go very deep. Well, I don't think that my experience is that it's, if you want to live together in harmony, you have to live together in love, and if you want to live together in love, then to a certain extent you have to die to your own independence, to your own, to the independent life that you want to have. You don't get to live in harmony without paying a price. And generally what happens is people want to live in harmony and still be their independent self.
Maybe you have to respect people's territory.
You're going to get me... We're going to get off... Yes, I mean, don't get me started. And then, and so you end up in a, it all starts in your partnership, really. It all starts between the love relationship with the chosen other. That's where it all begins. If you can't get the harmony, if you can't find the loving harmony there, if you come to the compromise, you know, I was good to begin with, but now we live our own lives, you know, we're good companions, and so long as I don't tread on your toes, you don't tread on mine.
It's just the communal thing.
I'm not recommending living in a community. I want my own space,
yes.
Thanks. But
yes.
there's still a place where I have my own space, where I'm connected to other people.
Yeah.
Not in the way that people are connected in their little bungalows, in Worthing, you know, where the whole structure of the way everyone's living is, they've already died. Sorry, anyone from Worthing. They have these little white things outside there, you know, along the street, you know, to stop the cars parking on the grass in front of my house. And I've got them too, you know. But they're like tombstones. The conclusion of this lecture is that language is a hybrid. It evolved from music, representing the urge to communicate, and to that extent it retains its right hemispheric empathetic elements. But referential language, with its huge vocabulary, sophisticated syntax, did not originate in a drive to communicate, but in a drive to manipulate and control. And it represents something of a hijack of that original development of language. And it now attempts to obscure its parentage. And skipping over that paragraph, because we're going to have lunch, the gist of what he's saying is that his story is, language, if you like, was born in the right hemisphere. The left hemisphere has come along and hijacked it. But in fact, it hasn't, because the left hemisphere utterly depends on the right hemisphere in order for language to have any meaning whatsoever. Do you know that the left hemisphere can't function on its own? And neither can the right. You know, and if you like, it's like Toller. He's got the same message. The same message is that the answer is the left has to come to recognise its dependence on the right. That's the gist of the story of language as far as McGilchrist is concerned.
It's so weird that we're symmetrical, that everything is
evolved. Yeah, I mean, it would be nice. It would be nice if we could say, you know, what does God? What did God have in mind? You know, once it would be. If there was someone we could phone up and say, "Excuse me, God, what was the left and right hemisphere about?" You know, what was, you know, oh really? There's no line, isn't there?
You have to have that asymmetry to make things.